Come on.
Oh, the dog situation.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Alec Mappa Hot Mess with Matthew Dempsey, psychotherapist. I'm Alec Mappa. I'm an actor, comedian, and housewife. And right now my dogs are going bananas. You hear that?
Talking about hot mess, I'm Matthew Dempsey. I'm a psychotherapist and multicultural counselor.
I'm so glad to talk to you every Wednesday. And I was thinking about this morning about how...
Alec, it's Thursday.
Is it Thursday?
Well, we record on Thursdays, but our shows air on Tuesdays. Either way, it's not Wednesday.
It's Thursday. Okay. So I did this. I came up with this podcast because I went for years without getting any mental health help because I was embarrassed.
Yeah.
And culturally, I was embarrassed to talk about it. I was ashamed. Do you come into contact with a lot of that with people who are just starting to seek help?
Yeah, for sure.
Or talk about mental health?
Yeah, for sure. It's one of the things that I kind of like also about the fact that virtual therapy is now so much more widely available because I think people that are accessing therapy even more because it's like just a half step less intimidating. But in general, yeah, a lot of people feel very uncomfortable coming into therapy. You know, there's a lot of stigma around it. It feels like there's something wrong and you're having to ask for support around life things that you feel like you should know. And of course, how should we know these things? So yeah, it's a lot of shit.
Wow. So what's your intake like? Are you kind of listening? Are you deciding, I don't want to hang out with this person ever.
No, I'm usually very, I mean, it has to be pretty extreme cases for me to not take somebody on.
Oh, really?
But most of the time I do. Most of the time people that come to me, I can pretty much work with anybody. What?
I could work with anybody.
No, I mean that there's really not so much that kind of like precludes me from being able to support people.
All right.
But yeah, I mean, I'm very conversational. I'm very kind of casual in my approach to things. There's a lot of shit going on in the background to make sure that I'm paying attention to everything I need to and doing the interventions that I need to.
Got it.
In terms of, you know, what it's like, you know, with me and a potential new client, it's just a conversation. Yeah.
I was very pragmatic when I started therapy in 2007 with the current therapist. I basically came in with like a chart presentation. Well, like PowerPoint presentation.
Already telling your therapist so much.
Yeah. I'm this sick. No, I came in with an agenda of things that were bugging me and I needed to process. And yeah. I was very well aware of these are my blocks. And this is what I want to work on. And I think the biggest thing about therapy for me was when I talk about things out loud, that I think are deep, dark secrets and I'm a horrible person. Yeah. My therapist will basically shrug and go, and?
Right.
You know, it's out loud is less terrifying than,
Totally. I mean, first of all, the fact that you came in knowing kind of very specific things that you wanted to focus on is amazing. As a therapist, I love that. Yeah. When clients come in and they've already given it some thought and they have some ideas of what they want to do, it's a little bit more challenging when clients come in and say like, I just need to talk to somebody, but I don't know. It's like, okay, well, we've got a lot of work to do, but we can do it. But yeah, so it is kind of helpful for that. But just being able to talk about the shit itself, however you get there inevitably, is such a big healing component of it. Just being able to put it out there. It's so interesting. The talking cure, exactly.
Wasn't it referred to that back in the olden days? The talking cure.
I don't know. I'm a psychotherapist of the new end days.
in the Freudian times, it was referred to.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, especially then, right? Because like really, that was such a culture when people didn't talk about anything at all. At least now there's so much more vulnerability and openness and access to these conversations.
Yeah. I want it to become as normal as going to the dentist.
Right. And so was that even just defining what normal meant? Was that a big part of your therapy?
No, yes, for me. But when I saw the immediate benefits of things, my main takeaway from my therapy was the voices in my head are really harsh.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah.
To the point of cruelty.
Yes.
Like my therapist would would stop me and he goes, all right, listen. I know you're joking. I know you're a comic, but the words you're using to describe yourself are pretty heinous.
Very harsh. Yeah. And very typical for a lot of comedians too, right? To just be so just harsh with yourself, kind of use yourself as the humor and all of that. Mm-hmm. Can be really challenging. I've talked to comedians before about how difficult it is to maintain that kind of humor and also enough of a separation in your own mind where you're not constantly absorbing that.
That's
gotta be a difficult task.
But in noticing that about myself, I also started to notice it in others, like, wow.
Yeah.
You're really hard on yourself.
Yeah. Our words have a lot of power. That's why it's really important for things like practicing gratitude, also practicing affirmations.
That's right. My affirmation. Yeah. I'm not so bad.
No, I remember it's interesting that you're talking about that because, first of all, yes, we are always our own worst critics. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I very first started out in as a therapist and was, you know, doing clinic work, and I was working with this one client who I could not stand. Hated seeing him. I hated working with him.
That's what I'm talking about.
It was just so incredibly negative. And then would also try and kind of like come at me, would just try to like take me down a little bit. And it was just so unpleasant. And I remember talking to my—
Where's the boundary professionally? Where do you go, wait a second?
Well, so if any time that there is something that's coming against me, I'll speak up to that part of it. And I'll say, you can't talk to me like this. This is
I'm not
okay.
Your bitch. Why don't hang your shit on me.
Let's find a different way to express maybe what you're talking about. But just the fact that he was so overwhelmingly negative, I remember talking to my supervisor about it. And I was like, I don't know if I can work with him. I'm like, he is so negative. It's too much. And I'm a brand new therapist, right? So I didn't know at the time what to do. And he said, just think about it for a minute. First of all, what you're getting from him is a drop in the bucket compared to what he is doing to himself inside. And you have to sit with him for 45 minutes once a week. He has to live with that every single day, every single minute. And that really rung true because now when I'm, whether personally or professionally, if I'm with somebody that I feel is so kind of just like a lot and just negative and toxic, I have so much more compassion for what that must be like for them.
All right. So how would you deregulate somebody like that? Is it your job as a therapist just kind of let them sit in that? Or do you kind of redirect it or try to offer an alternative perspective?
Yes. A huge, huge, huge part of the intervention for something like that is being able to model exactly what they can't do for themselves, which is compassion, right? Mm. Like what I was just talking about, that one client, I wasn't having compassion for him. I was sitting in judgment, which is what he's doing for himself all the time. So if I have the capacity to be able to dig deep and be able to find things about him that are redeeming and maybe just try to reflect that back to him, now we're not only setting a tone for what compassion looks like, but I'm starting to now, you know, bridge the gap between me and the client in a way that helps build rapport and trust. And then we can start doing more concrete interventions to deregulate.
Did it change anything? Did you find that in that approach that you taking judgment out of it, did it change his dynamic?
100% with that client, with all clients, with all personal relationships. When you're able to kind of just like dig deep and find that love over judgment, it always makes, you know, such a shift.
I was doing a play at the Public Theater in New York City with an actor who was a complete pain in the neck. And I could not stand working with him. I just didn't like him. And it was just like everything about him bugged me and it was frustrating. And I was like trying to reach him and then I found the same thing when you said judgment. I was like, I was judging him and I looked at the script and I was like, my job in this play is just to adore him. That's my whole character. So I came in with that from the minute I walked in. My whole verb was, I love everything about you.
Yeah.
I love, oh my God, isn't he adorable? Isn't he gorgeous? And that changed everything. It changed his acting. It changed the engagement between us.
Yeah.
I still for him personally, but it changed the dynamic completely.
Yeah. And you're very good at that. I've seen you obviously with all of our guests, even just experiencing it myself. You have such an incredible gift at being able to make people feel so comfortable, but not in like a bullshit kind of Hollywood way.
In a very
sincere way. Like you actually find, you know, whatever light exists in a person and you know how to, you know, shine that.
Well, I'm curious curious about our guests. And I, you know, we have them on here because we invite amazing people. We have Sandra Bernhardt, Isaac Mizrahi, Morgan Fairchild. We had that great conversation with Jody Sweetin.
Yep.
I mean, just kind of like, and everybody's story, everybody's individual story has been interesting so far. There haven't been any duds.
Well, that's true. But we also have, we've also had an array of personalities,
yes.
You know? And so, but the way that no matter who the person is, what they bring to the table, how their personalities are, you have a really great ability to be able to find that kind of special thing in a person. And that's something that is, you know, that not everybody has. So,
Thank you. I'm going to accept that compliment.
Good. You deserve it.
How's that?
That's great.
Normally I would bat it away by saying something. Well, you know, I was raised by a rageaholic, so I know how to read the room. I'm so excited about our guest today.
I am too.
We have a really, really great guest. You guys stick around because we have the one and only Alaska Thunderfuck.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
All right, thanks guys for coming back. We're very excited to talk to our next guest. She's a phenomenal drag performer and recording artist. You may know her from her appearance on the 5th season of RuPaul's Drag Race and her win on RuPaul's Drag Race All-Stars Season 2. She now co-hosts her own podcast based on RuPaul's Drag Race called Race Chaser.
She also created and hosts the Drag Queen of the Year pageant, which is amazing and all digital, so everyone can check it out. Welcome to the show, the one, the only, you know her, you love her, Alaska Thunderfuck.
Yay!
Hi!
How's it going?
I'm so excited that you're here. I want to talk about your experience on the show. You had submitted yourself to the show like every other minute.
That's right. Yes, every single time I was allowed to do so.
So how fast does the machine work? Okay, the show starts airing. Your story starts airing. How fast do you feel like, oh, I'm famous now, it feels different?
I mean, in my case, it was a little, I mean, it was faster than normal, I think, because the year before I first got on, my partner at the time was on and won the show. And so it was like, right, Sharon. And it was sort of like expected that it was my turn next. And so like, things started to, I was swept up in her, you know, her storm of it. And then I went and did mine and it all just like escalated and happened.
I didn't even think about that. You had the previous year to kind of go through her whirlwind.
Yeah, and it was a fucking whirlwind. Yeah.
What made it a whirlwind?
Yeah.
I mean, it was suddenly like, okay, so we went from we didn't have enough money to pay the light bill to suddenly we did have enough money to pay the light bill and we had enough money to buy cocaine too.
Yeah.
So, and it went from like it just suddenly all the doors were open and everyone was saying, yes, you can have drinks and you can have drugs and you can have whatever you want. All of a sudden.
Yeah.
And not everybody handles that well.
Right. Not everyone does.
Yeah.
Yeah. What was that like dating somebody like in such a similar space as you? Because I've been in relationships before where I have, I think especially as gay guys, it's comparing apples to apples sometimes. And I've felt like mm-hmm. very insecure. I compare myself. I feel like I'm not measuring up. Like that's been an issue for me in the past. Was there ever any of that competition that existed in your relationship?
Well, not really, because I mean, Sharon was really, really the alpha. Like she was the dominant personality. She was the dominant person. She was in charge. She made all the decisions. So it was actually very easy when that was the dynamic because it sort of functioned. But then once I started like my own journey and I had to figure out like what I was doing and what I wanted out of all of this, that's when it sort of, you know, completely imploded in.
Oh, because you weren't in a subservient position anymore. It wasn't like, okay, you have your own little plot of land as well. And how did your relationship dynamic change? And, you know, how did you notice it?
Well, I felt like, I mean, at a certain point, we just sort of stopped like seeing each other. Like we stopped talking. And I think that, I mean, for my part, I know that I got really swept up in everything. I was doing coke a lot. And I started like having like dalliances romantically outside of our relationship, which we were very monogamous the whole time we were dating, which was like 4 years until sort of the end. And then it got then it was a little loosey-goosey. And then it was like, oh my God, I know that I've cheated on him. So I need to just, whenever I'm around him, all I want to do is scream out, oh my God, I cheated on you. I'm so sorry. But instead of doing that, I just got wasted and we just got wasted.
Yeah, that's a choice.
That's a choice.
That's a choice that I've made a whole bunch. Cocaine ruins everybody. And I've seen it happen like in real time with people. Yeah. Like it's a real mind altering drug. Totally. Until I see people and it's like, you're not you anymore.
Yeah.
But even
thinking about like any of it, right? Like getting wasted or getting, you know, or on coke or whatever it is, it's like to help really quiet down the noise and kind of like dull the pain of the shame that comes up for us, right? Mm-hmm. Like, especially if we're doing, you know, if we've stepped outside of the relationship, you know, relationships are so difficult and fucking layered. And so it's really, there's so much to pay attention to and understand maybe why people aren't connecting anymore or why we maybe kind of step out at times. But like, these are generally not the conversations we have. We generally think like, if you cheated, you're bad, you're terrible. And so then we can feel all of that shame ourselves too. And it's just easier to say like, fuck this and just get wasted.
Right.
And it's the whole behind the music thing. I mean, every single behind the music special on VH1 is exactly the same story. Nobody's supposed to get everything they want all at once. And very few people are in. I mean, nobody really has that conversation because it's like, oh, boo-hoo, you got famous. You got a lot of attention. Everybody gave you drinks. But it's true that it's like the RuPaul says that fame is a drug and everybody reacts on it differently. And of the girls who've gone through the show, I've seen who's handled it and who hasn't, you know? And so walk us through your experience of like getting to a bad place and realizing you were in a bad place.
Well, Michelle Visage was very helpful during that journey, actually, because we became really close doing a production of the Rocky Horror Show. So we were like living in a house together for like a month. So we became really close and it was sort of like, that was very much like toward the end of mine and Sharon's relationship. And it was really unraveling and I was partying a lot. And she was basically like, if you, you know, I mean, this is your chance right now. And if you become known as the queen who just shows up and gets wasted and then pulls the dick out on stage, then this is going to be a very short run. And that's going to be your reputation. That's going to be it. And so like that, I was like, I don't, you know, I want this to be I want to have longevity and do this because this is what I've worked for so long for. Yeah. So that was really a turning point. And part of that meant I needed to like come clean with Sharon, and we needed to figure out what the fuck we were doing, or we were just gonna like implode. And then, yeah, then we imploded and then we broke up, and then I stopped drinking for a while, which was great. I basically stopped drinking as revenge toward Sharon, because I was like, every day of our entire relationship, we got drunk. That was what we did. So it was like sort of when you pick up all the personal effects that you gifts you got from your ex and you burn them in a box. It was like me putting away drinking was like really, really severing that tie. But it ended up being so fucking transformative, because I got to figure out what drag was like for real, sober. And it was like rad, and I got to fall in love with it. And that was a major turning point.
Was there anything that was like scary about it, kind of like doing it sober now?
Well, yeah, I mean, being on stage is terrifying.
Terrifying.
Yeah.
So it was learning. It went back to when I was like acting in like college. Like, I was never wasted when I was on stage doing that. But it was great. And so it was like getting back to that and like flexing that muscle of like, yes, it is terrifying to go on stage. And then that terrifying feeling transmutes into good shit on stage. So like your instincts are better and your improv is better. And like, it's a better performance. So it was like relearning that.
Because you're right, it is. I'm never scared when I'm on stage, but right before I go on, I'm always like, I perform with Jackie a lot, and like her ritual is like 10 minutes before we go on, Jackie Beat, 10 minutes before we go on, she's always like, why are we doing this? I don't want to do this. Why are we doing this? And then on stage, she's fine. But I always feel like, I was at the Laugh Factory with Judy Tenuta, and we were backstage, and like, we both had that wide-eyed look that, you know, like we're about to be shot. And then I looked at her and I was like, why are we doing this? And she said, I don't know.
And I hear from so many performers, and they're like, yeah, I want to just take like have a drink to like get my nerves off, or like take a pill or whatever. And it's like, no, like those nerves are fucking horrible, but that's your fuel on stage, at least for me.
You think that being drunk on stage makes you braver, but actually it just makes you talk longer. I'm kidding. You've been on stage for 3 hours. Get off. It's so interesting. Like with the journey of people who go on Drag Race, you're one of the few people who's gone beyond your year. You went beyond your year. It's how you can modify it. Cause you go to Drag Con and you see some queens who there's no line for them. What was that your plan? You said longevity earlier. Did you have a concrete plan of like, how am I going to keep this relevant? This, the character of Alaska.
Well, I mean, I wish that, you know, I could be smart enough to have had a plan. I pretty much I'm extremely lucky, but I also work really hard. And so it's like a mixture of those things. I don't think that it's just like, oh, I work harder than other queens. So it's like, there's so much that goes into, it's such a fucking gamble, especially with Drag Race, what your journey is going to be like, and what it's going to become. So like, and a lot of it has to do with what story is told on the show. If the story is told that you're great and you're funny and you're fierce, and then like, good for you. But also the show can fucking be like, you're adult, you're stupid, and you know, you're bad at drag. And then that becomes your story to this huge audience. And that's like really, so I don't know. I mean, it's like, you know, it's luck and it's.
Told our producer that after the second time you were on for All Stars, you experienced a bit of a backlash. What was that about?
Well, I threw a fit on the show because I was doing really good the whole season, and then I did really bad. And so instead of doing
the relative makeover challenge, I'm a super fan. So I was myself. Uh-huh.
And my mom was there. Mm-hmm. So they were like, so I was sitting on the stage and they were like, you're ugly. Your mom is ugly. You're terrible. And I was like, and so I freaked out. And so instead of doing what I would do at home, which is like, go in my room and freak out and cry and write my journal. Mm-hmm. Instead of doing that, I had 8 cameras on me.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so I just sort of like let it like explode. And I was like, and so I threw a fit. I started like, I tried to bribe one of the contestants to like not vote me out. And it was just a really like ugly moment that I'm used to with myself.
Sure.
I live with that monster every single day.
Mm.
But the Drag Race audience had only seen the, you know, lighthearted, wacky, funny,
quirky
version of me. So it was like I had this community that was so supportive of me for years. And they were rooting for me and they were behind me. And then all of a sudden, with one episode of television, it completely 100% turned the other direction. And it was, you're a snake, you're a fake ass bitch. I used to be your fan and now I'm not. And it was that, as it was just a maelstrom of that. And I mean, the show was bigger than it had ever been at that time. Right. So
and it was real time. It was while the show was happening.
Yes.
Yeah.
A show that you filmed like a year ago is now on the air.
So that whole year, I knew this was coming. I knew the episode was coming. I knew it was going to be disastrous. I didn't know how bad. I knew it was coming. Then it happened. And then it was just like this thing that had been my identity, which was like, I'm Alaska from Drag Race. I have a community of people who loves me and supports me and loves my music and the work I'm putting out. And then that had been so much my identity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then suddenly it was like, oh no, you are bad now.
Wait, Alaska, what do you remember the moment? Like, was it you saw something on social media or what was the moment that you started to realize everybody was turning?
It was, and I, you know, I.
And by everybody, is it like a couple of haters or is it like a whole wave of yuck?
No, it was everyone. It was everyone. And I'm not the person who delves into the comment section because it's a toilet bowl and it makes me feel like shit.
I can't take it. I won't look. I won't I don't read reviews. Like people say, you read reviews. It's like, no, because you take it too personally. If it's good, I take it personally. Then I'm full of shit. Like, I'm amazing. Yeah. And if it's bad, then I'm shit. And you know, it's just, no. Yeah.
But this was to the point where it wasn't even just in the comment sections. It was tweets at me and it was messages to me and it was emails and it was like I couldn't even just say, oh, I'm not gonna turn it on. It was like every time I picked up this
like
thing,
from every
phone,
it was
people telling me that I'm awful and I'm a monster.
So how do you separate yourself from that or get to a point where you're like, I always talk about it like, where do I get to the point where I'm not taking it personally?
Well, how did it in that moment? Sorry, I like not to cut you, but like in the moment, what do you remember feeling? Was there just like panic? Was it anxiety? Were you feeling depressed? Like, what was the mood of it?
Yeah, it was all of those. It was, I was feeling magenta.
Fellow girls.
Yes. Yes, it was panic. It was sadness. It was like, I felt really betrayed because I guess I took it personally that, you know, that I had a community that supported me and I thought that was real. And I guess it sort of liberated me from the falsehood of believing that was real.
Okay.
Yes.
Yes.
And I thought it was just like, oh, well, yeah, of course they like me. I'm great. I'm good at drag. I like, you know, so of course. And then it was like, well, no, that shouldn't be part of your identity because it's just typing in the computer. So it's not real.
Totally.
It's that thing. We were talking with Jody, who was on Full House for years and years and years. Mm-hmm. And she's like, the work it takes to separate yourself from what you do, to not identify, I'm not what I do. I'm a completely different thing from what I do. And that's what's important.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's very easy for us to over-identify with what we do, especially in the culture that we live in, just generally, where, you know, we're forced to kind of like hustle and work and make money and, you know, show something of ourselves. We over-identify with that. So that when there's any kind of, you know, any backlash to that part of ourselves, it doesn't just feel like, oh, fuck, there's like some setback or I'm getting some heat. It feels like, wow, everybody hates who I am. And then you can kind of feel that. And it's so hard when something like that happens, especially when we've really kind of, you know, started, you know, drinking the Kool-Aid of it all, then, you know, for it to send us into a tailspin where, like, I've had this happen to me before too, even with just like mild little things on social media, where it's like, I start to feel like some panic or anxiety or even, you know, like depression. And it can just like put you into a dark fucking place.
I know. Yeah. And I see so many people go through it. I mean, I've been doing this a long time. So I had my moment where I was not great.
What was your moment, Alec? What was your thing?
That bit me in the ass. I worked all the time when I first started out. All the time. I worked nonstop for 3 years. I moved to Los Angeles and I didn't work for 3 years. Yeah. And I identified with what I did more than anything. Yeah. And so without a job, without being in the spotlight, I was like, I'm a piece of shit.
Yeah.
And it was really like, I really felt like I was nothing. And it took me so long to get back to a place where it's like, I'm not what I do.
Right.
I'm not what I do. And now when I work, when I'm on a film set, when I'm on a television show, I'm like, this is part of my day. And I'm really grateful for it.
Yes.
Because it really enables me to live the way that I do. You know, and it's kind of like, it's not who I am. And I'm prone to my own depressions, you know. I don't say unemployed. I say I'm in between artistic triumphs.
That's good.
Because sometimes, I mean, I've had times where I haven't worked for a year, you know, I'll do some gigs. I'll, you know, that's why stand-up's so great. Well, it was great. But there are times where you just kind of are, nothing's happening.
Yeah.
You can't take it personally. And you really, if you don't know who you are and what your value is as a human being, you will suffer. You know, I add that on to my own chemical depression.
Yeah.
You know, and it was like,
totally. You know? Yeah.
But I see friends, Alaska all the time become famous and it's kind of like, okay, she's having her moment.
Yeah.
You know,
so Alaska, for you, when did you realize that you were maybe kind of like going through like a heavier kind of like mood, that darkness? Like, how did you identify that? And then what did you do with it? How did you get through it?
Well, I mean, I think I started to really delineate a separation. So I became like really way more private about my real life.
Yeah. Yeah.
And not wanting to just put everything out on the table and just becoming like really protective of the like squishy human being that was behind the whole thing. And then it was like, and then, I mean, as far as like outwardly, I just completely absorbed it and owned it and said, yes, I am the snake queen bitch. So I'm a nasty fucking monster. So I'm gonna write nasty fucking monster on a t-shirt and sell it to you, you know? So it was like
ownership. So, it sounds like ownership.
Yeah.
Right. Totally ownership. I had to completely own it because it was like, it was no surprise to me the way I was acting on that show. I just had never done it on that show. So no one had been introduced to it publicly, but like, I know I'm a monster to myself all the time.
But like the two things that stand out to me about that, one is boundaries, making sure that you're not giving everything of who you are out to everybody, you know, with like no boundary at all. You created that boundary. So you only offered now very consciously what you wanted to. And then the other part of that too, was you were rewriting your own fucking narrative. right? It's like, don't let somebody else pick up your pen when writing your story. And so you took it, you worked with what you had, whatever the mess was there in the moment, and you put a spin on it, and you were then able to move forward with that too. I think both of those strategies are amazing.
I love the word squishy. There's
I do too. I love that word.
That's so great. There's such self-knowledge in that about vulnerability, and something squishy should not be exposed. It has to be taken care of. And I love that.
I do too.
Description. You have a great event coming up that you're hosting. Can you tell us about it? Tell us all about it.
Well, in 2019, we did this experiment, and we basically were like, my dear friend Lola LaCroix and I, we decided to put on a pageant that was like sort of open to all types of performers on the same stage. So it was like, we had cis, like AFAB, like female performers. We had like a trans performer. We had someone from Dragula. We had like, so it was like, we had like illusionists. So it was very like, we're shoving all these different types of drag and drag performers onto one stage and seeing what happened. Fine. And what ended up happening was like the fiercest drag show ever. So we were putting it off to do it again until like the world reopened. And then the world's reopening, but America is a little late. Instead of holding out for a theater, we're like, why don't we just do it digitally this year? So we're going to do it digitally on March 7th on Sessions Live, which is a really amazing streaming platform. And we have an amazing lineup of queens, and it's going to be really great. Queens and kings.
I love that. I love the inclusivity of things, of like letting everybody kind of let their freak flag fly.
Yeah, exactly.
That was a tongue twister. I was going to get through that one. Did you hear that? I almost had a stroke. That's great. I love the inclusivity of it. Real quick, I always like ask drag queens there. Like, I feel like the creation of a drag queen is always like a superhero origin story. Like, where does Alaska come from? Because there is a definite characteristic about her, the kind of queen that she is and her mannerisms. How did that come about?
Marijuana.
Yeah.
Mostly. I mean, really? Well, first of all, the name comes from marijuana. Like, it's stolen from a strain of marijuana called Alaskan Thunderfuck. Then it was like, I moved to LA and I felt like a weirdo and a freak because I'm from Pennsylvania. So I think that's where like the alien thing came from. Because I actually felt like I don't belong here in this weird show business land. And so I was doing drag to like, just like soothe my soul. It was I was not trying to pursue it as a career. I was just doing it to like stay sane.
Yeah.
And then it ended up opening a lot of doors. And so I just pursued it. But I really feel like the character of her being Alaska, being from space, and like, it really, I feel like it channeled itself into me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel like it, I don't know, it's its own thing that exists, and I am a channel to let it flow forward.
I love that. Yeah. I am but a vessel for Alaska. Yes. Not much of my own. I am a vessel.
Yeah. I mean, and you and Taylor Swift, both from Pennsylvania. So there's obviously space here for everybody.
Because you're a Pittsburgher, right? Isn't that where you're from? You guys lived in Pittsburgh?
I lived in Pittsburgh for many years. I grew up in Erie, Pennsylvania, which is like 2 hours from Pittsburgh.
Okay.
I love that. I just love the creation of like the drag character, the drag queen becomes the champion of you, of the person inhabiting it. The stories that we've heard, Matthew, on the show are people are empowered by that persona.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah, for me, that's stand up. It's like on stage, I can get away with murder. Off stage, that would be.
Yeah. But Alec, you were kind of saying the same thing. Interestingly, I think for all of us, because Alec, you said that when you were younger, you, in order to just be able to kind of like thrive in your house, to make your dad laugh, you would have to just be funny, right? Mm-hmm. And that was kind of your outlet. That was your way of coping. Alaska, for you, like you said, moving to a place where you felt out of place. being able to dive into that character. It wasn't like you were trying to be a star. It was, that was the thing that was working for you and was a coping mechanism for you. For me, I'm a therapist because, you know, turning inward and being able to self-reflect and all that stuff was like my way of trying to make sense of the world around me. Yeah. And then like organically, all of these things for all of us kind of lend themselves to these paths for us.
Yeah, definitely.
So where are you at with the fandom now? Like, have we gotten back to one? Are you objective about it? I mean, what's it like now?
Well, now it's like, you know, I do work that I care about, and that I like, and sometimes it's a hit, sometimes it's a miss. And, you know, it's like, so, you know, but ultimately I keep doing it because I love doing drag. Love it. I love it so much. So like, even if I'm doing it and no one's watching or no one's listening, it's like, I'm still ultimately going to do it.
Yeah.
So I'm just, totally. I'm grateful when it's a hit. I try to not let it be completely gloom and doom when it's not. And, you know, I don't know, keep going.
Yeah, I've seen you perform live a bunch. You know what you're doing.
Yeah, well, but also it sounds like you know what you're doing, especially because your intention is set that you're doing it for you first. You're not doing it like for the applause and for everybody else. You do it for yourself first. And like Oprah says, you have to find that spark of joy within you that you can light it so that you can illuminate the world in your own way.
Thanks, Oprah.
Thank you, Oprah.
No, but that's the thing about like a performer, when it's just you out there, there really has to become a point where it's like, I make the decision to enjoy myself no matter what.
Right.
That if I come off stage and I'm like, God damn it, then that's on me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because there are ways to save yourself even when things go sideways. There are ways to kind of go, you just acknowledge it. Well, there we go. It's kind of like, I thought that was funny when I wrote it. Apparently it's not. Fuck you guys. Fuck all of you. You're garbage people. Where can I talk to you forever? I feel like we haven't seen each other in forever. And I miss the tribe of East Side people in Los Angeles, Casita del Campo, performing with people and performing live. I really, really miss it. We always end the show with a, you've given us so many pearls of wisdom. I'm going to walk away with Squishy. Squishy's my favorite new
word. Kind of
mental health.
Squishy too.
Because it's not judgmental. It's not like, no. I'm bad, I'm weak. It's like, it's squishy.
Yeah, there's something very like sweet and precious about it too. And also relatable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's your hot message of the day? We always end with, you know, given what people are going through, you know, if you talked about feeling like an alien and feeling different from everybody else. And every year, another busload full of people empties into Los Angeles and they're all weirdos.
Yes.
Yeah. So what would your words of wisdom be to the new crop of weirdos coming into town who don't feel like they fit in anywhere?
Well, I mean, I guess the wisdom generally is like taking the things that you think are weird about yourself, that you think that nobody wants to see or nobody should see. Those might be the things that are gold, you know, that make you special and like sort of invite in other people who feel like there are parts of themselves they can't show. So like take those things that you think are ugly or dumb and like put those out front and say, hi, here it is.
Here she is, world. Here she is, folks. Where can folks find you on your social medias?
On Instagram, I'm at the only Alaska 5000. And then you can just go to alaskathunderfuck.com and buy my t-shirt.
Pictures of me. Thank you so much for doing the show.
Yeah, thank you.
You are a bright light and easy on the eyes. You're a very pretty, pretty boy.
Thank you.
Because, you know, really, that's all that matters. how we look
That's
on the
That's the takeaway from today.
That's the takeaway. Los
takeaway
Angeles.
For today's episode.
Step it up. All right. Wow. Love you so much. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Thank you for doing this podcast.
Ladies and gentlemen.
What are you doing?
What do you mean?
Keep it simple.
I'm making the promo.
Just keep it simple. Just say, hey, we're the Brav Bros, two guys that talk about Bravo.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we're the Brav Bros.
No.
Oh.
Dude, stop with the voice. Just keep it simple.
I've seen promos on TV, dude. This is how you get the fans engaged. This is how you get listeners. We're trying to get listeners here. If we just say, oh, we're two dudes that talk about Bravo, people are going to get tired of it already. We need some oomph.
All right, then fine. Let's try to do it with your voice.
Brav Bros.
Good job.
Wow, that was great, Matthew.
Yeah, I really love that conversation. Yep.
What's your hot message?
I think that my hot message is kind of what we were talking about somewhere in the middle of the show today, which is you can't buy into any of it. Like, you can't buy into all the applause, the accolades, all that kind of attention. You can't buy into that, even though it's really tempting and really easy. Because if you buy into that, then you're also going to have to buy into the shit that comes with that. The hate, the unfollows, the nasty DMs. So you can't over-identify with that.
You can't.
No.
No, it's poison.
What about you? What's yours? Aside from squishy, what's your hot mess?
Fame is a booby prize. Give me the cash. That's my hot message of the day. I'd rather have money. I'd rather have money than be famous. This is like famous, like piggybacking on you. Because you're very large. I'm a little guy. Fame is fickle. It comes and it goes. And when it comes, you got to know who you are.
Yeah.
So that you'll be okay when it goes. And it'll come and it'll go. It'll come and it'll go. You can't identify with any of it. Where can we find you on your social, big boy?
You can find me at MJ Dempsey Psych on Instagram and Twitter, and Matthew J. Dempsey Psychotherapy on Facebook.
I haven't seen you in person in so long. I've forgotten, like,
it's
how
been
tall are you?
So long.
How tall are you?
You're like a 2-ish?
Yeah, you're a big fella. You can find me. That's what I say, big boy. I always think about you like getting hit by a car and then just getting up and like, Jesus, God. You can find me at Alec Mop on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. I'm not even drunk yet. And you can find us both at Stage 29 Podcasts on Twitter and the Instagram. DM us. We want to hear from you. We're going to do a whole show where we just answer questions from the audience. Somebody wrote me the other day and said, do you and Matthew get along? Are you guys friends? And I'm like, yeah, what is it about this?
Really?
It seems like we're not on the same page, is what I thought. Anyway, don't forget to download and subscribe. We love hearing from you, and tune in next week for some more hot mess fun.
Bye, everybody. This podcast has been produced by Stage 29 Productions for entertainment purposes only. The contents of this podcast does not constitute medical or professional advice, do not reflect the opinions of this company, any of its parent companies, affiliates, subsidiaries, promotional sponsors, or advertising agencies. The views expressed by the hosts and guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. For more information, please go to stage29.tv.